Thank you very much, Council and colleagues, Madam Clerk. This is the last en banc argument of 2020. I've asked Associate Chief Justice Mark Gibbons to preside. Mark Gibbons will be retiring from the Nevada Supreme Court effective January 4th, 2021. So this will not only be the last en banc oral argument of the year, but the last of his long and illustrious career on the court as presiding justice. I'd like to acknowledge in the courtroom today in Las Vegas, Mark's wife, Sandy Gibbons, and thank her for her support and good cheer all the years we've worked together and the various events we've been to at the Conference of Chief Justices and others. I don't know if you remember as vividly as I do, but the time in Vermont where we met the Malinois police dog together and had a great time. Briefly, I'd like to trace Justice Gibbons's judicial career. He was elected to the district court bench in 1996. He served as judge and chief judge until his election in 2020 to the Nevada Supreme Court, where he has served for the last 18 years. I count myself so fortunate to have worked with Justice Gibbons on many, many cases. We also worked together on a number of committees, including most significantly the Committee to Update and Revise the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure. The work of that committee took place, ended and became effective in March of 2019. Justice Gibbons has served Nevada with dignity, grace, and humility. He has been one of the most productive and energetic justices the court has had, always prepared and always pushing to reach the correct result in a timely, fair, and principled way. Justice Gibbons is a deeply courteous and kind human being, even in disagreement or dissent. It has been my privilege to serve with such a distinguished and remarkable man. Thank you so much, Justice Gibbons, for your friendship and collegiality over the past 12 years for me and 18 years for the citizens of Nevada and your service on the bench. With that, I'll pass the gavel back to Associate Chief Justice Mark Gibbons.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chief. And with that being said, we better get going with the arguments. I don't want to keep our attorneys waiting here, so we'll call the case. It's case number 79818, Lisa Guzman, appellant versus Robert Johnson et al. Respondents, case number 79818. Counsel on behalf of the appellants are Juan Monteverde and Michael Palestina. On behalf of the respondent, Kirk B. Lenhard, Max Fataz, and John Hardiman. This is a 60-minute oral argument, so the appellants may reserve time for rebuttal if you wish to do so. So on behalf of the appellants, who's going to speak first on behalf of the appellants?
Good morning. This is Juan Monteverde. I will be speaking for the appellants.
Hey, Mr. Monteverde, would you like to reserve any time of your 30-minute argument for rebuttal?
Yes, please. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. So you'll get a little beep but when it gets to 25 minutes or 5 minutes left, and you'll see the clock on this video screen, and we'll try and suspend all questions at that time, and so you can reserve your time for rebuttal. Okay, on behalf of the appellants, Mr. Monteverde, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Juan Monteverde with Monteverde and Associates for the appellant. Today we have a case before this court that requires reversal of dismissal on two separate and distinct grounds. First, we ask dismissal be reversed because the plaintiff did sustain a claim against the Board of Directors for fiduciary duty by rebutting the business judgment rule by either operation of law based on Nevada precedent, because a controller bought the company, and there were allegations in the complaint that the price was unfair and the process was unfair. Or two, because there is facts that support rebutting the business judgment rule. Under either scenario, reversal is appropriate. Separate and apart, regardless of what happens with count one, I will call, we have a claim against AMC, the controller or majority shareholder, which cannot be protected under business judgment rule, which owes fiduciary duties to the shareholders, to the minority shareholders, and a claim against AMC should also have not been dismissed. Those are my two claims, and I will proceed talking first about the board of directors this morning. The business judgment rule, it is a powerful tool that the defendants can have. But in this instance, because there was a controller that bought the company, a majority shareholder, there is precedent in Nevada, the Foster case from this court back from 1958, that provides that only if inherent fairness or close scrutiny can be met, can business judgment rule be a shield. But they can't do that because we have alleged unfair price and unfair process, and the appellee cannot sustain or prove that our allegations are inaccurate. So as a matter of law, this case should have not been dismissed. The big argument appellee has is, well, in 1991, business judgment rule was codified. So what, I say? Because that doesn't change the law. In fact, statutes must always be interpreted within the time frame they're enacted, within the law that exists at that time. And even if you were to give some credit to that argument, which we don't think the court should, there's subsequent cases that demonstrate that inherent fairness is still the law in Nevada. And that was the Schoen case from 2006. And even earlier this year, the Windmill case also was citing Schoen, and by analogy, I would argue, Foster. But even if you want to say, let's not look at Foster, let's not look at Schoen, I say let's look at Cohen also. Unrelated to Foster, another opinion from this court from 2003. In there, the majority shareholder of Boardwalk, I should say, was sued by the minority shareholder for orchestrating a transaction in which the minority claimed that the majority shareholder of Boardwalk bought parcels from the directors of Boardwalk that were adjacent and close to their hotel, to then engage in a merger with Mirage. And the minority alleged that the majority was paid more for, or that the majority paid more to those directors for their property than they should have, and that they then paid less in the merger to the minority. So Cohen is right on point in the sense that
Mr. Monteverde, this is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. Can Cohen be distinguished from this case, because here you have an independent committee facilitating the merger versus a majority shareholders facilitating the merger?
Yeah, I don't think so. And if we're going to talk about that issue, I think perhaps we really need to talk about how the law might have evolved outside Nevada. And that's some of the citations in our briefing talking about MFW and why it's important to point out that MFW brings the dual protections is precisely because it's to try to replicate an arm's length transaction. Just one provision, that is a special committee, is not enough because the special committee doesn't have really power to turn the transaction down. All they can do is try to negotiate, right? And when you add the second provision from MFW with a majority of the minority approving the transaction, it is those two things together that really try to replicate arm's length. So I would support that there is no difference here because having a special committee made no difference and inherent fairness still applies. But even if you were to say, let's get past Cohen, so let's get past the idea of, as a matter of law, right, rebutting the business judgment, we have facts that we believe are bad facts that were pled that support us rebutting the business judgment. And I have five in particular. One is the CEO of the company was conflicted from the start by agreeing to roll over his own personal equity, which is millions of dollars, into the new transaction with AMC, and agreeing to accept post-roll employment or post-close employment with the surviving entity. The board also allowed the CEO to engage in this transaction or rollover transaction. And then the special committee they created really didn't have power, but more problematically, allowed or encouraged management to lower and adjust its projections. And within days of that happening, lowering the projections on April, or requesting it on April 4th, its CFO quits And then the banker that renders a fairness opinion uses the lower projections. Those facts alone allow plaintiff to have pled a claim that should have survived the motion to dismiss, because certainly those are facts that demonstrate that the business judgment is rebutted. And I think that's really what this case is about. So whether you want to say we're going to look at inherent fairness and rely on Foster and rely on Schoen and also rely on Cohen, or whether you want to say we're going to look at the facts, under either scenario, the case should have proceeded to discovery. And defendants, by the way, they don't get out at a 12B motion. They can certainly try to get out before trial with a 12C motion. That's what you do if you want to fight facts, or at a summary judgment. But a 12B motion should really be an issue that is clearly a failure to state a claim. And when you have powerful facts like the ones we have here, I don't think you can do that. And talking about, because there was also some discussion in the briefing of what is this MFW, and I know I've touched upon a little bit, what's the importance of it? It's, again, you're trying to replicate a stranger's negotiating. And it makes sense because here you have a buyer, a controlling shareholder, who had a lot of power. And AMC not only got the CEO in its back pocket, AMC also made clear to the board, to the special committee, don't even bother shopping the company. Don't even bother exploring another transaction. We're not selling. And they may be entitled.
Mr. Monteverdi, if I could interrupt you for a second, please. I think we understand your point here. As you probably know, the Supreme Court announced a new decision on the business judgment rule in the case of Chur versus 8th Judicial District Court, 136 Nevada 88, 2020. I just would ask you, what impact do you think this case has on the to the facts and the legal issues in the Guzman case?
Thank you. And great question. The answer is none whatsoever. And the reason is, Chur doesn't change the law. And we're not asking to change the law either about business judgment rule. Chur says business judgment rule will apply to no matter what claim you bring. In Chur, the issue was that there was a gross negligence claim, a care claim. And the court misinterpreted how you would apply the law as if you don't have to prove anything beyond gross negligence. That's not true. You have to prove bad faith at trial, whether it's a disclosure or whether it's a price claim. So it is true that Church just clarifies, and properly, that business judgment rule applies to all claims. What we're saying is we are able to rebut the business judgment rule at the pleading stage, either because Nevada has clear precedent, as a matter of law we do that, or alternatively, because we have bad facts that were appropriately pled that show we could also rebut the business judgment rule. That's our position. Does that address the court's question?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
You may proceed.
Mr. Monteverdi, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Waving so you can see who's talking to you.
Okay.
So under the Chur case, like, wouldn't that Chur, let me ask it this way. To the extent that you're relying on Foster, and Foster seems to present a scheme that sort of shifts the burden of proof to the defendant directors to establish the fairness of the transaction, et cetera, how would that square with the presumption under the statutory business judgment rule and the requirement for the plaintiff to bear to have the burden to rebut the presumption?
Yeah, so I'll take it in the opposite order. No matter what doctrine or what level of scrutiny you apply, a plaintiff has as an officer of the court, we have an obligation to present good faith facts. We can just make money. So let's start with that. I couldn't be before this court and say, wait a second, controller, inherent fairness, I want to litigate. I must present some facts that show that the price was unfair and there was an unfair process. We have done that. By doing that, then, at trial, defendants will have to prove that what they did was appropriate, that they were doing fair dealing. And we, the plaintiff, would be able to rebut that shifting burden with evidence that shows the contrary. So we're not suggesting that all of a sudden, because you have a controller, every time a shareholder can just walk into court. That's not what happens. A shareholder must still have facts that can prove, or can allege, I should say, that it was an unfair price and an unfair process. That's how I think you can reconcile those decisions.
Mr. Monteverde, what facts can you put forth that shows that the independent committee's decision was the product of fraud or self-interest per the Wynn decision?
The Wynn decision, I think, talks about whether business judgment applied because of attorney privilege documents, but taking it from there, I think allowing the board to allow the CEO to engage in a rollover equity agreement from the start is problematic. Allowing the special committee to force management to lower the projections is problematic. You have a CFO that resigns shortly after. I think that enhances or underscores our argument that this was a problem. And you then have a banker who uses that to lower its valuation, and you have a board that says we're going to rely on the banker analysis when they very well know it only could happen because they told management to lower the projections. And to put one example, the discounted cash flow analysis goes from 825 on the top end to 629 on the top end with the adjusted projections, and this was a 625 offer. So I think it becomes evident that the board allowing that to happen, it's a violation of the law. And again, at a pleading stage, I think that suffices. I hope that addressed it, but I'm happy to follow up if there's more questions on that point. On the business judgment, I would also add, this case is governed by the 2017 business judgment. And I think it's also important that in 2019, the language changed, and the language changed to eliminate or delete the words try or fact, must determine or find. Again, I think that enhances or underscores our view that at a motion to dismiss, business judgment needs to have a finding, a factual finding, and it could not be had in this case, not other cases, not in general, not a per se rule, in this case, because we allege facts. And when you allege facts, facts cannot be resolved at a motion to dismiss under 12b-5. Defendants could have tried a 12c motion. They could have tried to put some evidence why they think this was a fair process. But let me just point this, and this is the best way of doing this, and I'm skipping a little bit ahead on AMC. The defendants admit in their proxy statement at page 65 of the proxy, which is on the record, citing in our complaint JA-42, that AMC entities attempted to negotiate the terms of a transaction that would be most favorable to them, and accordingly did not negotiate the merger agreement with a goal of obtaining terms that were fair to the RLJ shareholders. That's an admission. This was not a fair transaction for RLJ shareholders. And we have facts that also support this position. And at the end of the day, at a motion to dismiss, this case should have not been dismissed. That simple. Let me jump ahead on the AMC claim.
Mr. Monteverde, this is Justice Hardesty. Before you go into the AMC claims, could you clarify something for me? My understanding is that the investment agreement that was entered into in August of 2016 between the RLJE and Digital was approved by the shareholders of RLJE. Is that right?
Yes, but that has no bearing on...
Well,
you certainly can.
What was the vote of the RLJE shareholders in approving that investment agreement, please? Was it unanimous?
I, of the shareholders. I don't know the tally, to be honest, Your Honor. I know that in this transaction, the one we're challenging, the majority of the minority of the public shareholders did not approve the transaction.
No, but at least with respect to the investment agreement, that was approved by a majority of the RLJE shareholders, at least, if not all.
Well, yeah, I doubt it would have been all because we're talking millions of shares, but Your Honor is probably correct. There was a majority approving that transaction.
Was the no-shop provision that was contained in that agreement something that would have had to have been considered by the committee in negotiating the merger?
Yeah, but the committee, right, they had that provision in place. That's why the special committee asked AMC or told AMC, we want to be able to shop the company. And AMC then made it clear they were not, that they thought that would be a futile exercise.
What I'm trying to understand is, wasn't the no shop provision binding on RLJE in entering into the negotiations on the merger? Was binding on that contract, wasn't it, in the investment agreement?
Certainly. I see Your Honor's point, but there's other issues, which is then why the special committee forces management to lower the projections. That was not in the investment agreement. They were not required to do that behavior. The investment agreement did not allow the CEO, Johnson, to essentially be bought off early on with a rollover equity. So, taking that fact alone, Your Honor, would be correct. They had a contractual right to not shop the company.
Okay.
That doesn't mean they have a contractual right to be unfair.
Well, I was going to say,
and that's exactly.
They had a contractual obligation not to shop.
Correct, yeah. But that doesn't mean that AMC has a contractual right to treat the minority unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, shopping. A no-shop is very different than exploring a transaction with others. And what's the difference? Well, the difference is in a no-shop, you say, we're not going to sell. In a canvassing or exploration, you're going to say, we just want to know what other people hypothetically might pay, so me, the special committee member, can negotiate better against you, the controlling buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important distinction, which again underscores.
And then I was wondering if you could address one other question I had. You made a statement here earlier that the select committee did not have the ability to reject the merger. I was wondering where you get that from. If there had not been agreement on the price, if the committee had said, well, we're holding it at six, and then they eventually get higher than six. If the committee had eventually told AMC, we're not going to sell at the price you're offering, are you saying that the committee was contractually obligated to proceed with the merger? I don't see that. Where do you get that from?
We get it from the real world. Your Honor is correct. Contractually, they could say no. But when they asked AMC, if we say no, please commit, AMC commit to not take retribution actions against the board, AMC refuse. And that's what you have seen in other cases or other transactions where the controlling shareholder says, we want to do a deal. We don't want to sell to anyone else. If the board rejects us, we commit to not take retribution actions, meaning we commit to not replacing the board members. Here, that coercive sentiment or coercive spirit was not eradicated. It was actually reinforced. So that's what we mean, Your Honor. But Your Honor is correct. It wasn't a contractual right. It was a real-world experience problem, which is what happens when a majority comes in and bullies the minority and bullies the special committee.
Mr. Monteverdi, this is Justice Stiglitz. Didn't the special committee members agree to give up their board seats as part of their participation in the special on the special committee, in which case they wouldn't be subject to this coercive real-world effect that you're talking about?
Well, I think they gave up the seats if the transaction happened, not if the transaction didn't happen. So what we're talking about, and that's also what happened, and that's the reality of a proxy cost contest fight. if you are director of a publicly traded company, one thing is for you to say, I'm no longer going to be a director because we enter into a new deal, I'm stepping down, and the transaction closes and the company ceases from existing, then you as a director are getting kicked out. It's like quitting a job or getting fired. If you go look for another job, is it better to say, no, I resigned, I no longer was happy there, or the company went under, so I left because there was no company anymore, then say, no, I got fired because I didn't do a good job. That's the distinction, again, bringing it to the real world analogy. So I want to touch upon AMC a little bit. AMC, without a doubt, should have not been dismissed. AMC owes fiduciary obligations to the minority. We get that from Cohen. Cohen specifically talks about page 16 in the opinion. It says they, referring to majority shareholders, can also involve allegations that the majority shareholders breach their limited fiduciary duties. And it has a footnote to Weinberger, which is a Delaware case. So this idea that, well, what fiduciary duties does a majority shareholder have? They're nowhere delineated. Well, they're nowhere delineated anywhere for anyone. That's what common law provides. But we look at Weinberger, and Weinberger tells us that a majority shareholder must act fairly. And fair behavior or fair conduct doesn't mean to pay a fair price, for example. It doesn't mean to pay the best price. It doesn't mean to give every dollar that under the sun one could give. It means to be fair. And certainly the price paid here, we don't believe what was fair. We believe the price would have never actually happened without the projections being lowered by the special committee. And second, fair process. What does fair process mean? Well, fair process doesn't mean get the second largest shareholder, Mr. Johnson, to commit in February 2018 to support you, AMC, no matter what, because you're giving them an opportunity to roll over his equity interest in the new company, which the minority doesn't get. That's two different directions, right? So that's bad process. So I think we have alleged that. And the proxy, like I said earlier, and we cited in our complaint, is JA42 again, admits that AMC was not acting fairly. And some of the facts I've already talked about, but I'll say them again. AMC got Johnson on their back pocket from the start. AMC did not allow the company to even do a market check or market canvassing to at least get a sense of what price would be fair. And AMC did not agree to not take action against the board. And most problematic, AMC did not allow for a majority of the minority to be implemented. And there's a reason. And the reason is because they knew they were not paying a good price, and they knew the shareholders would probably not approve the deal. And at the end of the day, if you were to look at the tally, the shareholders did not, the minority did not approve the deal. The deal passed because you have shares accounted for that include Mr. Johnson's shares. But the minority did not approve this. So, again, these are problematic issues. And at the end of the day, even if you want to not be sure about that, business judgment does not apply to a shareholder. The own words of the statute are directors and officers. I'll take one more minute. And in that, if I point you to the Wynn opinion, which you may be thinking about, that was different because it was talking about, yeah, it's directors and officers, but this is the board's action. And here, it's not the board's action we're worried about. We're worried about AMC's action. It's the other side of the deal. One could, I suppose, argue that the board might be okay because they're protected legally. We don't agree, but we could reach that conclusion, I suppose. But that doesn't mean that AMC is also protected. Not on the face of an admission, we were not fair to RLJ shareholders. Unless there is a question, I would reserve the remaining of my balance of time.
Thank you. Any further questions from the court in Las Vegas? Any up in Carson City, including Justice Stiglitz in her chambers? Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Monteverdi. You may reserve the balance of your time. We'll now proceed with the argument of the respondents. I don't know if it's being divided. Mr. Lenhart, I see you standing up, so why don't you go ahead and proceed, and if you're going to divide time with your...
I assume the camera's on me. This is a kind of a new experience.
Yes, it is. We can see you fine.
All right, thank you, and thank you for letting me stand. I'm very uncomfortable arguing from the seated position. May it please the court, Kirk Lenhart, on behalf of the named defendants and respondents in this appeal. I think in light of the court's questions and the comments of Mr. Monteverdi this morning, it's important for me to reset a couple of the issues before the court today. First and foremost, as I think the court is very well aware, we're talking about a stockholder contesting a merger between AMC and the RLJ entertainment entities. In the context of this type of merger, the Nevada legislature has historically favored and trusted a director's judgment. That is the reason for the codification of the Nevada Business Judgment Rule as codified in NRS 78.178. A stockholder, at a minimum, has an absolute duty to plead facts to rebut the business judgment rule. That has not been changed through the 30 years since this rule was codified. These plaintiffs had a chance to amend. Judge Gonzalez told them their complaint was wanting. Their complaint was deficient. They had a chance to amend, and they rejected that opportunity. That's the background are today. Now, Judge Gonzalez, well, first of all, it's beyond dispute that for the past 30 years, the business judgment rule has really protected the actions of directors and officers in the exercise of their duties. As director and officer follows the rule, there's a minimum litigation risk, and more importantly, it avoids second-guessing of reasonable decisions for its officers by... Judge Gonzalez has, as this court is very well aware, has through the past years on numerous occasions dealt with applications of the business judgment rule and the three-part analysis that's involved here. And she engaged in that analysis in this case. She immediately determined, first of all, whether the directors and officers exercised their powers in good faith in accordance with the statute. Adhere to the presumption that they are presumed to have acted in good faith on an informed basis and with a view to the interests of the corporation. And she finally held these plaintiffs to the standard that if they are to establish any breach of that duty, any breach of the fiduciary duty, they have to establish intentional misconduct, fraud, or a knowing violation of the law. All of this is recently affirmed in the Chura decision. The two questions before the court were clear. One, had these plaintiffs pled a sufficient cause of action to rebut the presumption? Judge Gonzalez said, no, you have a right to amend. He rejected that offer. So what do? They come into the court before Judge Gonzalez and try to change the playing field. They try to get Judge Gonzalez to rewrite the business judgment rule to import the Delaware inherent fairness doctrine. They would have this court, or Judge Gonzalez for that matter, require any transaction involving a controlling shareholder be judged by the inherent fairness standard. And the burden of establishing inherent fairness can only be established after a complete trial. In other words, they ask Judge Gonzalez, rewrite the business judgment rule in the case of a controlling shareholder transaction. She rejected that opportunity. When they rejected the opportunity to amend, she promptly dismissed the complaint. She was right on both counts. I think it is critical here to look at the facts from a detached point of view for a second. The facts that Judge Gonzalez was reviewing when she reviewed the complaint, because there are key core facts in this case that will now relate as to facts, are contained in the complaint or documents attached to the complaint. As you know, the merger at issue is between AMC, the owner of several cable channels, and RLJ Entertainment, the owner of Acorn Television, Urban Movie Channel, and the Black Entertainment Television Network. Robert L. Johnson was a well-known African-American businessman. It is clear from the facts that there was a tr- true attempt to combine, to comply with the requirements of the business judgment rule. And the case really starts on August 19, 2016. As Justice Hardesty has pointed out, at that time, a credit agreement was reached between AMC and the RLJE entities. The credit agreement provided for a $65 million credit facility, and there was a need, obviously, for this funds. But there was also two contractual conditions. The first contractual condition was AMC retained the right to execute warrants to give it a majority ownership interest in the RLJE entities. That, very importantly for this case, there was a stop. There's not the usual radical shop provisions, but this one was contractually created. It was a contractual requirement. And it provided that there could not be an acquisition proposal that was not approved by AMC. Nothing unusual. It was just a statement of reality. The key point downplayed by the Guzman plaintiffs that was raised by one of the justices this morning was a majority, and I can't give you the exact number. I'm sorry, I didn't anticipate the question. But the majority of the RLJE shareholders approved this transaction with the contractual requirements that I previously discussed. So the RLG stockholders approved the transaction and contractually bound themselves to the no-shop provision. This then brings us to the transaction that brings us to the court today, which is the February 26, 2018 tender by AMC. On that date, as the court's very well aware, AMC tendered the price of $4.25 a share to the remaining RLJE shareholders. There was a reminder of no stock provision in this tender, but there were also two other provisions that indicate the propriety of what AMC was doing. AMC typically advised the RLJE that they expected RLJE to form a special committee of independent directors to respond to our proposal on behalf of the RLJE public shareholders. They also encouraged the special committee to retain its own legal and financial advisors to assist in the review. AMC was bending over backward for right. They told the other side of the transaction, yes, they had made a deal with Mr. Johnson, they told the other side of the transaction, form a special committee and negotiate with us. That is exactly what they should have done and exactly what they did. The committee appointed Mr. Laszlo, Mr. Royster. The complainant acknowledges that neither one of these individuals had a commercial, financial, or business affiliation or relationship with AMC or any of their respective affiliates. And they were all delegated to full authority to negotiate with AMC and to approve or disapprove of any transaction. And that's exactly what they did. On both sides of this transaction, whether it be the AMC side or the RLJE side, there's an absolute attempt to comply with the requirements of the business judgment rule. What's the first thing that this committee does? Goes out and hires an international law firm, Greenberg and Trower, a well-known law firm to provide legal advice. They hire Allen and Company to provide financial advice. The characterization of the negotiations by this committee as a sham negotiation is unfair. Yes, the no-shop provision was enforced. It was a contractual provision. Of course it was enforced. But on four separate occasions, this committee said no. It started on April 5. They rejected the $4.25 initial offer as being unacceptable based on the advice from their advisors. On May 2, they rejected a second for $4.92, again, based on the advice of their advisors. On May 16, they state, we will accept nothing less than $6, again, based on the advice of their advisor. On May 22, AMC counters at $5.95. They're still trying to nickel and dime it down. The committee says no, and they say, we'll take $6.25. It's accepted on May 22. They said no on numerous occasions. And one of the justices asked, what is the effect of saying no? If they had said no and there was not a counter, this transaction would have ended. That's exactly what was supposed to occur here. This is what business judgment rule was envisioned to work. You create an independent committee. The committee hires They negotiate a price, or they negotiate a price, but they act in faith. This is how the business judgment rule was always envisioned to work. And it's important also, because the complaint is filled with allegations what AMC could have done. AMC didn't leverage its power here. AMC didn't take control of the board. AMC didn't force a sale. AMC negotiated. As a result of those negotiations, what happened? On the date before the transaction announced, the stock was selling for $3.87 a share. The next day, the negotiated price was announced at $6 a share. Stockholder approval was obtained. Obviously, there was an increase in value. Obviously, this committee behaved in the way it was expected to behave. Their actions are sham, is unfortunate, and I said inappropriate.
Mr. Lenhard, Justice Kavish in Carson City. So
I'm trying to find.
Here I am. Okay. Okay, so my question is as to the allegations by the plaintiffs that they somehow artificially repressed the value of the company, as discussed by Mr. Monteverdi this morning. Given that this is the pleading stage, isn't that enough to raise a claim that they failed to use due care or acted inappropriately that potentially down the road would rebut the business judgment rule?
If I understand the question correctly, you're saying that AMC attempted to depress the price?
No. That the special committee ended up reducing the value.
I'm with you now. I misunderstood the question. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Isn't that the quintessential exercise of business judgment, which value to utilize in determining the fair value of the stock? This is exactly why we have a business judgment rule. So a court, and I say this carefully, so a court does not second guess the exercise of business judgment by the committee. The committee and its advisors decided the lower valuation was the appropriate valuation to utilize. That should not be second-guessed by this court unless you can find a knowing violation of the law, intentional misconduct, or fraud. And they frankly have not pled any of those three elements, so they don't get by the exculpatory provisions contained in 7A of the, or 7B of the statute.
Thank you.
Did I answer your question? Or
yes, you did. Thank you, Mr. Lenhard.
In response, and I made this point earlier in front of Judge Gonzalez, what is this appeal about? Their attempt to rewrite the business judgment rule and change the playing field. Here's what they're really asking this court to do, and it's clear. They're asking this court to interpret NRS 78.138 as automatically rebutted as a matter of law when every Nevada corporation transacts with a controlling stockholder, and that respondents bear the burden of both good faith and inherent fairness of the merger. They're trying to turn the presumption on its ear. They're asking you to judicially legislate what the legislature has not for 30 years. The legislatures have 30 years to amend this statute to do what Mr. Monteverdi is asking you to do this morning, and has chosen not to do it. What they're in essence asking you to do is create a special class of litigants. And basically create a burden of proof on inherent fairness to go and be established after a full and complete trial. Again, they're at the business judgment rule. And this brings us to the Sure decision, which I think was referred to this morning by one of the justices. What they are asking you to do is exactly what you would not do in Sure. The length of the business judgment rule is clear, it's concise, and it's easy to understand. When you were faced in the Sure decision with applying the Schoen dicta to apply a new standard that the business judgment rule does not protect for gross negligence, you refused to do it. I'm suggesting here that, as in Sure, to the extent Schoen conflicts with the plaintiff's business judgment rule, those should be disregarded. But I want you to look closely, if you would, at footnote 61. Of the Schoen decision. That's the footnote where the inherent fairness doctrine is discussed. If you look at that footnote, it says, an approval of an industry director transaction by an independent committee is not possible. Well, we have an independent committee here. And based on that, if you read the footnote closely, we are in conformity with what we did. We are in conformity with the vote. We're not required to reverse that footnote or question that footnote. The fact is, what they are asking you to do, to rewrite the statute, is not called for insurance. Is not called for insurance. In fact, this court made it clear not rewrite the statute. They're going one step further, and this may be the most alarming part of their argument. They're suggesting to you the exculpatory language contained in the Nevada Business Judgment Rule should also be disregarded in the case of a controlling share transaction. What they are arguing basically is, first, you have a presumption that the director acts in good faith is automatically rebutted in the case of a controlling shareholder transaction. Then they argue that it's de facto misconduct in a shareholder transaction. So therefore, the exculpatory provisions contained in Section 7 of the statute are to be ignored. You are being asked to totally disregard this statute in the case of a controlling shareholder transaction. That is, and again, I say this carefully, that is a job for the Nevada legislature. It is not a job for the courts. And this court historically has refused to rewrite statutory language, excuse me, to interpret or rewrite statutory language. They've left it to the legislature.
Mr. Lenhart, what do you make of the fact that when this occurred, this merger, each in the statute referred to the trier of fact making this determination?
That doesn't give a plaintiff a free ride. The district court is still the gatekeeper on a review of a complaint. If the complaint doesn't meet muster, if it does not plead sufficiently facts to rebut the presumption of good faith, if it does not plead exculpatory facts contained in subsection 7, intentional misconduct, fraud, or knowing violation of the law, the district court, even under that two-year window with the trier of fact language was in the statute, the district court still has a duty to dismiss. You don't get a free jury, no matter how shoddy or improper or whatever the thing is lacking. You don't get a free trial. The court still has its gatekeeping function, and even under that statute, Judge Gonzalez did it. In our brief, it is not uncommon for these cases to be dismissed if you have failed to meet the requirements of the Nevada Business Judgment Rule.
Mr. Lenhart, I apologize. This is Justice Kadish again.
Yes.
I just want to make sure factually that I have the sequence of events correct. So there's the two-person special committee that we've talked about who ultimately approved the proposed merger, and then a shareholder vote. I want to be clear that there was no, or was there, a board vote where any other members of the board of directors made a vote or were asked to make a vote on approving or not approving the transaction, except to the extent they're shareholders and voted as shareholders.
The only vote of any board was to put this into the hands of a special committee, which is selected for the two directors. That's the extent of it. Once the two directors approved the transaction, it went to the shareholders.
So to the extent that other members of the board of directors are alleged to have had their various alleged conflicts of interest, they didn't actually make an up or down vote on this transaction as a board member. Is that correct?
That's correct. The only thing the other board members did in this case was refer the matter to a special committee that was not conflicted. And I'm going to go through the allegations of conflict in just a second. But that's all the other board members did. And quite frankly, I can't see how that's a violation of the battle law.
Okay. Thank you. And are you going to address at some point in your time the claims against AMC?
Yes. At the tail end of my argument. Yes, I am.
Perfect. Go on.
Thank you. I shouldn't have to remind the court, but I will remind the court briefly of what you said of the pleading requirements, because you outlined them in Sure, and this is what they're trying to avoid. The author of the decision, I think it was Justice Hardesty in Sure, made it clear that in referring this case to the Insurance Commission, the commission must allege facts that, when taken as true, rebut the business judgment rule and constitute a breach of fiduciary duty involving intentional misconduct, fraud, or a knowing violation of the law. You have to allege everything. They are trying to tell you now that the second part of that, you don't have to allege a breach of fiduciary duty involving intentional misconduct, fraud, or knowing violation of the law. They're asking you to reverse Sure. They're also asking to reverse another aspect of Sure, where Justice Hardesty stated, you must also plead that the claimant must establish that a director or officer had knowledge that the alleged conduct was wrongful. Again, Sure sets out the clear pleading requirements. I think Sure should be followed or reaffirmed by this court, which means the motion to dismiss should have been granted. Now let's go, if I can, briefly to the allegations as to the independent directors. The claims against Mr. Laszlo and Mr. Royster are very simple. According to the plaintiffs, they lacked independence. And they lacked independence because they were protecting their reputation or were afraid of a career-ending ouster if they voted the wrong way as an independent director. Well, first of all, that doesn't make a lot of sense because they said no on four separate occasions. So they took that chance on four separate occasions before they approved the $6.25 transaction. But secondly, there is not a case in Delaware, for that matter, or Nevada, that holds this type of allegation is sufficient to conflict or in any way challenge the independence of a director. Remember, they're not being removed for bad acts or incompetence. We're talking about them being challenged because they might have a career-ending ouster or a threat to their reputation. Well, what is the ultimate effect of this argument? Every vote of a director on any corporate entity could be challenged on the basis that he voted the wrong way, he can be removed from the board, he voted the wrong way, it could affect his career. It would freeze all corporate activity. That type of allegation borders on the nonsensical. The other part is key, and one of the justices already pointed it out. Both of these men agreed to resign as part of the transaction. So their reputation or their career-threatening ouster didn't come into play. A couple of additional issues have been raised that were really not raised in front of Judge Gonzalez, but were raised in argument here this morning and were raised in the brief. One is the compensation received by the two gentlemen. They received $100,000 compensation. Well, they received that compensation whether they approved the merger or they failed to approve the merger. There's also a reference to their restricted stock. Let me remind the court, as we pointed out in our briefing, restricted stock was going to be in any event. Finally, their obligation didn't have an incentive to really get the stock price higher, make that much of their stock. Well, in the case of Mr. Royster, he made $370,000, $80,000 of which was a result of the increase in the stock price that he negotiated. Same with Mr. Laszlo, who received $347,000, $70,000 of which was part of the negotiated increased price. So they didn't leave money on the table, and they had no incentive to leave money on the table. If I can go briefly now to AMC, it's an important consideration. What did AMC do? AMC made a bid as a majority shareholder for the remaining stock of RLJE. There's nothing improper about making a bid. What did AMC do next? They did what any responsible corporate entity would do. The other side, create a committee and negotiate with us. Have that committee hire advisors. AMC did it right. What else could they have done? They didn't bully, as Mr. Monteverdi contends, they didn't bully the independent committee. There's no allegation in the complaint that AMC called one of the two independent committee members and said, you will support this price or else. because it didn't occur. AMC acted as a responsible corporate entity and did what they should. They created it. They asked for a test committee to be created, and they told that committee to hire advisors and negotiate with us. And this is the way the business judgment was supposed to work. Because what happened? The committee did negotiate. They negotiated the price up by $2 a share to the benefit of all. The court doesn't have any additional questions. I will cede my last one.
Mr. Linhard, sorry, this is Justice Kadish. So I just want to be clear about what is or isn't disputed then. I take it, and I think it's clear, but I just want to be sure on the record that there's no dispute that AMC as a majority shareholder here did owe a fiduciary duty to the minority shareholders. Is that right?
Well, now that's, Cohen doesn't say that, Your Honor. If the court's inclined to go that route and expand the fiduciary duty based on what Cohen states, it's unclear in Cohen that fiduciary duty goes from the majority to the minority. But let's assume for a second it does. It's okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. It's our position that we met our fiduciary duty when we contacted the RLJ entities and told them to form a special committee and hire advisors. There's nothing more we could have done. We didn't bully. We didn't in any way try to exert our influence. We did enforce the no-shop provision, but that's a contractual provision. That was our right. So there's nothing in here that would indicate any breach of any fiduciary duty on behalf of the AMC entity under the facts of this case as pled. Now, as I said again, it's up to the court if the court will expand the Cohen decision. But the Cohen decision, I do not think there is a story fiduciary duty.
And I just want to, I don't think anyone's claiming this, but again, just narrowing it in my mind, that the business judgment, would you agree, or do you assert that the business judgment rule and its analysis and the burdens that it sets out, do they apply to the claims against AMC?
AMC is not a stockholder. AMC is not a director or officer of RLJE. So I don't believe the business judgment rule applies to AMC.
Okay.
And we've not argued that. We've argued that they fulfilled any duty they had to the minority shareholders by their actions.
Great. Thank you.
Again, I'll feed my time. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Justice Pickering has a question.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Linhart, what do you make on the AMC issue of the allegation that before RLJE received AMC's initial proposal, Johnson entered into an agreement with AMC that is equity in the RLJE would roll over into a 17% ownership interest with the post-merger company? Isn't that enough to get them passed a motion to dismiss at the pleading stage as against AMC, independent of the claims against the individual officers and directors?
Absolutely not. I don't believe so. And the reason is there's no evidence in this complaint that Mr. Johnson in any way exercised his influence on the independent committee. The fact that Mr. Johnson had an equity ownership in AMC is really irrelevant. The real question is, did Mr. Johnson somehow bully or somehow influence the independent committee? There's nothing in the complaint to say that.
But they've had no discovery at this point, and they are alleging a feature of the transaction that we must accept those allegations as true, and I think they're asking us to infer impropriety from that.
And I would suggest inferring that impropriety, and that's all they have, is a stretch. And it's not appropriate. Well, it would be a great stretch to say that Mr. Johnson was a 17% shareholder. We cannot allege that he attempted anything against the independent directors. There are independent directors created, or an independent committee created by this transaction. and that the mere fact that Mr. Johnson became a shareholder of AMC somehow creates liability to AMC. Keep in mind, or liability on behalf of AMC, keep in mind it's AMC that went to the RLJ entities and said, create a special committee, hire advisors, and negotiate with us. It wasn't, we had Mr. Johnson in our hip pocket, create a special committee and negotiate with us. And in this case, there's no allegation at all. Like I said, the inference is so slight, I don't think it gets by the motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lenhard. Mr. Monteverde, you have about a little over 4 minutes left. You may proceed with your rebuttal.
I'm going to pick up from where my colleague just left off. I will direct this score to JA121. That is the statement in the proxy statement. It is precisely what happened. AMC got Johnson in their back pocket first, then went to RLJ and said, we want to buy for $4.25 all shares other than what we already own and what Johnson has. With that, go get a special committee and let's negotiate. That's what happened. Then the special committee said, hey, AMC, we want a majority of the minority. And AMC said, no. And they asked again, and they said, no, we are not going to agree to a majority of the minority. That's problematic, and it's a motion to dismiss. And with all the respect, what AMC did is improper, and I do believe the record would support it, but we haven't had discovery, and it's a motion to dismiss. AMC, if you want to look at Delaware law and what happened in MFW, the opposite happened in MFW. The controller said, we promised that it would not proceed with any going private proposal that did not have the support of the special committee. And essentially, that takes out the coerciveness of getting rid of this special committee after an proxy contest. Here, the opposite happened.
Mr. Monteverde, let me just ask this, Justice Kadish. So they had this negotiation ahead of time with Mr. Johnson, and let's say it's You pleaded it. Let's assume it's a very favorable deal for Mr. Johnson ahead of this negotiation. Ultimately, the negotiation is with the two-person independent special committee. So what? Like, why does it matter if that's not? I mean, he isn't the one who then approved the transaction on behalf of the company.
Well, he is, because he voted all his shares in favor of the deal. And he would have been the one most likely to oppose an unfair price because he had 29% of the company. And two numbers, 3,664,529 shares are held or owned by the minority. Only 1,676,211 approved it. That is 45%. They need Johnson to get majority. By giving him a special treatment from the start, the special committee loses leverage. A special committee would have been able to say, if you don't pay more, I cannot get you Johnson to support the deal. He has 29% of the shares. It's so wrong that I don't need to persuade you that it's wrong. But I do think we have alleged it's wrong, and this is a motion to dismiss. And by the way, I'm not asking this court to rewrite this judgment rule. AMC cannot avail itself to the business judgment rule. I'm also not asking that this court adopt laws from the Delaware regarding MFW. We didn't ask Gonzalez, Judge Gonzalez, either. It was a suggestion. We're asking, follow Nevada law. Foster is clear. Cohen is clear. Cohen says on page 35, mergers accomplished through arm's length negotiations with independent majority shareholders or directors require less judicial scrutiny, the mergers where corporations have common directors or majority shareholders. That's what we have here. We gotta have more scrutiny. And we're not asking that the business judgment be rewritten. Defendants essentially want it to be irrebuttable. That is not the law. It is rebuttable. We believe it's rebuttable by law because of Foster and because of Cohen. And even if you disagree, we believe it's rebuttable by our facts. And Chair did not change that law. Chair says all claims are subject to business judgment rule, and we agree, but it's rebuttable. We have rebutted it. Please allow this case to proceed through discovery. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Monteverdi, Mr. Lenhart, for your excellent arguments and briefs. We will take the case under submission at this time, and we'll be in recess to 2 o'clock p.m. this afternoon.